You are listening to The Tie.
I am Joe McDonald.
Sean Carter.
Brentley Romine.
DJ Pihowski.
Wright Thompson, and you're listening to The Tie Podcast.
The Tie.
The Tie Podcast.
The Tie.
Thank you for listening to The Tie.
Thank you for listening to The Tie.
I'm Dottie Pepper, and thank you for listening to The Tie.
Yeah, so it's really easy to start out with the best courses in the world, right? But there's like, there's hidden gems that not everybody's heard of.
Yeah, there you go. Drink lots of coffee, maybe even a little espresso.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to The Tie. This is Henry today bringing you an episode with recently turned professional Cole Hammer. Cole graduated from the University of Texas this past spring, where he was an NCAA champion and has many amateur accolades, playing in many majors, playing on a few Walker Cup teams, deep runs in the U.S. Amateur, and a lot more. Cole's been a friend for a while, and the last time we played together, we got to talking about the fact that I'm doing a podcast, and we like to talk about golf course architecture, to which Cole's eyes lit up, saying that he loves architecture and would love to come on to talk about it. So that's exactly what we did today. It was a lot of fun to hear about how Cole views architecture and competition, some of his favorite golf courses, what he's learned in the game from playing a lot of great golf courses, and a whole lot more. I hope you all enjoy this conversation. Thank you for being here. And without further ado, let's get to the episode with Cole. Cole Hammer, how you doing? Appreciate you joining me today.
I wouldn't want to be anywhere else, Henry Shipp. Thanks for, wanting to listen to me for an hour.
Absolutely. So you're at home in Houston now. We're going to be mostly focusing on golf course architecture today. You have a professed passion, and so I'm excited to hear more about that. But before we do, I'd love to hear just a state of the union on professional career, how the first summer went, and what the next season's looking like for you.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that amateur golf is over forever. But so I turned pro in June right after NCAAs, and played 8 out of 9 weeks, played 4 tour events and 4 Korn Ferry events in that span, and US Open qualifier before that. Unfortunately, the tour events didn't go so well. Played, like I said, 4 tournaments and only played 8 competitive rounds. So you can do the math there. But then Korn Ferry, I played pretty solid. I had a top 10, top 20, and made another cut. So some things to learn from, but also some things to build on. And overall, it wasn't like some massively successful summer, but I'm not displeased by it at all.
Totally. Yeah. Good chance to kind of get your feet wet and just figure things out. It's going to be a long career. So I don't think that, 3 or 4 months that didn't go exactly as you had hoped are probably going to mean all that much in the future.
Yeah. That's what I try to tell myself each day on the golf course is like, you know what, Cole, this is going to be a long career. But in the moment it feels like a do or die. So I'm trying to, figure out that mindset or at least that part of the process.
Understood. So we do have one more order of business before we get to talking about golf course architecture. It's become a rite of passage at the Tie for all guests to get into the dirt, drinking, eating, reading, and thinking. So tell me what it's been like the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a great question. If we're going to hop right into the drinking. So I've never been a coffee drinker before, like ever. And especially before competitive golf rounds. But over the last, I finished my last Korn Ferry event in mid August. And I came back, spent some time at home, and started to work out again, and to get up early in those mornings and actually have some motivation. I figured I'd give it a shot. I don't know if you're a coffee drinker or not, but it's pretty amazing how it'll just wake you up, obviously. And so I wouldn't say that I'm like a coffee aficionado by any means, but I'm starting to enjoy like a little cup of coffee before the day gets going. probably won't do it for competitive rounds because I kind of feel like I get the jitters, but you know, it's good on a day where I don't have much going on and I need to wake up for something.
You may not realize, Cole, but we're like maybe 40% a golf podcast and like 60% a coffee podcast. So
good. I just changed it to 61 and 39.
Precisely. Yeah. I am not a coffee drinker. I am a coffee addict. And you know, you kind of sound like someone that you're like just getting into something that you will become addicted to. Wouldn't you say, like, I don't see myself doing it before the round. Like, no, you're going to be doing it always before the round, during the round. It's bad. It's a wormhole. But anyway, love to hear it.
I guess we're going to have to revisit that topic in a little bit or there we go. In like a year. But all right, moving on to eating. Like I said, I've been working out. So like the eight weeks on the road this summer took a lot out of me and I managed to lose 10 pounds. So, I've been just eating everything in sight. So it's not really fair to like pick one thing that I've been eating. Although pretty much as boring as it is, exclusively eating eggs and like avocado and sausage for breakfast with a little toast. I mean, you could literally call me on any day of the week that ends in Y and I'd be eating eggs, sausage, avocado and toast. I don't know what it is, but it's like the only breakfast food I like in the morning. I mean, this is a whole nother topic, but like I'd rather breakfast is not my favorite meal of the day. So I'd rather eat, you know, lunch food at 10 a.m. than eat breakfast. But you know, I've been hammering eggs essentially. Moving on to reading. So I went up to Montana this summer and in July and went fly fishing for like 30 minutes. I'd done it before, but it had been a while. And I kind of just like fell in love with it, honestly. I fished a bunch growing up, but fly fishing is such a different animal. And my girlfriend, who I've been dating for about a year, got me an Orvis fly fishing book for my birthday. And went back up to Montana last week after having read that book, at least like, you know, the basics, and learned a lot and felt like I knew what I was doing a little bit. The book just kind of goes into like the intricacies of, you know, the different knots and like the different line weights and when you're like the different kind of casts and when you're supposed to use them and the different kind of fish. So, you know, I'm slowly working my way up to like a 10 handicap fly fisherman. I would say I'm about a 20 right now. But you know, that's been fun. And then I've also, after last week, I know that you're living in Austin now, but I've been reading all things Texas football just after the brutal loss last week and just trying to make myself feel better about it in any way possible.
The toughest thing about it, I'm not going to pretend as if I'm like actually a Texas fan, but I'm trying to get into it a bit. And the toughest thing about that is like playing Alabama. Like, I almost wish Texas had just missed the field goal or something with 90 seconds left. Cause as if there was any chance Bama wasn't going to do essentially precisely what they did, you know, no chance that game was ever going to be won when Texas took the lead.
When we kicked that field goal to go up 16. Oh yeah. I guess that was 1917 at the time.
1917. But yeah.
I was worried about when we went up 16-10, I knew it wasn't good enough. And I wanted to go for it. Obviously, I think everybody in hindsight would have gone for it. But, you know, I think our team is headed in the right direction for sure. I mean, we almost beat them with a second string quarterback on one leg. So I like the state of Texas football. That's for sure.
Good stuff.
And then thinking nothing crazy. I've just, you know, like I said, coming off my first summer of competitive golf, and, you know, the last month or so, and honestly, the next 2 months leading up to Q school, I don't really have much. So I'm trying to figure out like a daily plan, daily process. And so, you know, starting the week after Omaha, which was the last Corn Ferry event, like I've just been trying to figure out what works best for me, and just, you know, thinking about my process and how it needs to change and what I need to do on a daily basis other than just drinking a cup of coffee.
Great way to finish the dirt. That was fantastic. A little surprise there with the coffee. Excited to hear it. So let's hop straight into golf course architecture. So I want to start out with maybe my favorite question about GCA. It's just, what was the first course that you played that really made like a lasting impact on you where you said, hey, this is a little bit different than some of the other places I've seen, and kind of showed you that courses can be really, really neat?
Yeah. So it's really easy to start out with the best courses in the world, right? But there's like, there's hidden gems that not everybody's heard of. And I was lucky enough to play Pine Valley when I was young. With incredible, probably my, you know, favorite course in the world. But as I started to, you know, mature in GCA, I fell in love with the Country Club of Charleston. I don't know if, have you played there before?
Oh, you're just like crushing it today. I'm actually a member there. It's one of my favorite courses in the world. So this is,
yeah. Okay. So
you're just going on, it on top of it.
Great minds think alike. But anyways, I think I was like 15 or maybe 16 years old, and played in the Azalea Amateur there. And I mean, I don't think I'd played a South Rainer before. And that golf course is unbelievable. It's just funny, like the intricacies of the way the bunkers are staggered. You know, the greens are squared and very sectioned. And you get the reverse Redan hole on number 11. And it was just like, you know, it was like playing a different, just a completely different kind of golf. You really had to think your way around it. It's not bomb driver off the tee like every modern day golf course, but like, you know, you have to think about it on 90 yard wedge shot into a green, you know, when nowadays you almost never have to. It's just so straightforward. You got to think about where you're putting from. There's just so much slope in the greens. And I just felt like it was a thinking man's golf course. And there's just so many, you know, iconic holes out there that mimic some of the best designs in the world. And so I just fell in love with it. And then, you know, wanted to play more Rainer courses after that.
I think one of the things about Charleston that's great is it's super approachable from a standpoint of it can really show to you the intersection of skill and strategy, in that some of the simplest holes out there, like I think of, you know, the second hole or the fourth hole, as you talk about staggered bunkering, you get up there and you're like, especially if you're younger, you've never really thought about the difference between just simply execution and what you shoot. But you get to those holes and you're like, okay, so that bunker is about 300. And then the one on the left is about 275. And then the one beyond it is 315. And so you have to figure out like, okay, where do I want to hit it? How far do I need to hit it? And what sort of angle do I want into these greens? And yeah, the course makes it very, very approachable on figuring out. It's not just simply about point and shoot.
No, definitely not. But like you said about those staggered bunkers, like number two, you got that bunker on the left and the bunker on the right. But like, even if you try to lay up to the bunker on the right, that bunker on the left comes into play. So it's like, you have to think about how aggressive you want to get. Because, you know, as we both know, there's no guarantee that you're going to hit the fairway with a 3-wood or something like that.
That's for sure. What about understanding architecture better than probably a lot of guys out there do you feel like has helped you as a competitive golfer?
I really just think it's all about strategy. I mean, everybody knows that you don't want to short side yourself. There's ways to play golf courses to really set yourself up for a shot coming into the green where it's almost impossible to short side yourself. The golf courses where you just don't need to hit driver, there's no point in hitting driver. I mean, you hit an iron down there and have like 9-iron in. I mean, it's not that big of a difference. And having like a 50 degree wedge. I do think like the golf courses that have great like architecture, like a Country Club of Charleston or like a Shore Acres or a Chicago Golf Club, like I just think that you put me on a golf course like that, I'm excited to hit the different kind of shots. They're more shot making golf courses versus, you know, hitting it dead straight with a little fade every time, no matter what. You can use the ground. And so I think that I get excited to play those golf courses because I feel like the other golfers don't really understand that. But then, you know, even on a competitive golf course, I think being creative, or not a competitive, like a modern golf course, being creative is just as important. And so, you know, just growing up on some of those iconic courses helped me in becoming creative versus very one-dimensional, like some of the golfers are nowadays.
So as you alluded to that, something I wanted to ask you is, you know, you've played in a handful of majors, you've played in US Amateurs, Walker Cups, lots of great tournaments on great courses with great players. Do you feel like it's a bit of a fallacy? Now, of course, that there's strategy around, you know, the way that Bryson picked apart Wingfoot in 2020 in the US Open. I mean, his strategy was, hey, I want to be on the wide side of the hole and give myself a clean look to the green. But point being, do you think that it's a bit of a fallacy to say that a lot of the great players today are just kind of bomb and gouge without really thinking about it? Do you feel as if, having played with them in practice rounds and in competitive rounds and those different things, that people are thinking deeper about strategy than maybe it's alluded to?
I think that's a loaded question because there's players who definitely believe in the bomb and gouge mindset. And then there's guys who really don't believe it and play, you know, position golf and play spot to spot. I think it really depends on the player, like I said, but there is a massive contingency of guys out there who are not worried about how far they're hitting it. They feel like they can play the majority of the courses on the PGA Tour without hitting it 340 yards. Now, I mean, I think it's a massive advantage for the guys who just absolutely strive the ball off the tee and hit it 340 like Cameron Young or Rory. But, you know, not everybody has that ability. So guys are having to figure out ways to play around that. But like, I still think guys believe that fairways are important out there. I mean, I don't think anyone, I really don't think anyone standing up on the tee and just saying, all right, I'm going to hit this ball as hard as I can, and I don't really care where it goes, because obviously a 60-yard shot out of the rough is probably a little easier than a 7-iron, but like, that's not the discrepancy you're talking about. I mean, I think it's more of like a, you know, 120-yard shot out of the rough versus a right dead center of the fairway 8-iron or something like that. So I think there's plenty more guys out there trying to hit fairways and plot their way around golf courses than is advertised. And I wish that the public knew that fact, because I mean, some of the guys I've played with, I mean, it's just impressive how few fairways they miss. And as you know, I don't hit the ball very far by any means. But like, not that many guys out there are bombing it by me, other than, you know, the few. So I still think golf is a very, you know, you gotta, I think people still view it as an accuracy dominant game.
What's your take on distance versus architecture with regard to making courses more difficult for the highest level players? I feel like it really came to the forefront at the 2020 President's Cup at Royal Melbourne, where, you know, it's a 6,900 yard golf course, something like that. And it was bringing guys to their knees on a lot of different shots. What do you think about making courses long versus trying to use the tools of architecture to make them difficult for the best tournaments?
Right. Well, one of the great things about the best courses are the green contours. You only have tough, fast greens. I mean, I don't care how close you are to the green after your tee shot, you're going to be in for it. But I do worry a little bit about how far the golf ball's going, just because so many of the great golf courses like Country Club Charleston have that type of bunkering where you have to think about where you want to put the ball. But that 315 yard bunker for some people isn't in play. And so I think you do need to push a few of the tees back on the great, old golf courses that, you know, are like 69 to 7,100 yards, because you'll get guys hitting it over those bunkers. And I think you take a little bit of the intricacies of the hole out when guys are doing that. But, you know, I'm not too worried about it, because, you know, you still got to go play the golf course. Like I said, the greens are still challenging enough to where you got to hit the wedge shot perfect. But it would be nice to see guys have to deal with bunkers again. But I think the best way to mitigate the guys who are bombing it is to grow up the rough and narrow the fairways and make the greens firm. Because, I mean, I don't care how close you are, coming in with a wedge out of the rough with a rock hard green is almost impossible. So, you know, you hear Webb Simpson talk about it. You hear other guys talk about it. Just bring that rough in and just let it grow and let guys go play. And I just think it would put such an emphasis on the driver off the tee and ball striking and, you know, driving in general would become more than just swing hard for those top guys, at least, and bring everybody back into like a level playing field.
Yeah. And I think it kind of runs in stride with what people are talking about in the game today: distance, the importance of the driver, you know, everything that's kind of been dug up through strokes gained, showing that a lot of the best gains are to be made with the driver. To just really hammer it home on that and place so much emphasis on the driver, I think would make a lot of sense in professional golf.
I do too. I was having a conversation a few months back with Adam Scott, and he, you know, there's so much talk about the ball going too far. But he believes that, like, if you made the driver head smaller, a little more skill would be involved in hitting the driver straight. He thinks that the head's just too big. And if, you know, you go back to that, I don't know what the exact model was called, but it was TaylorMade driver in the late 90s, early 2000s. It was just a tiny head. And so, you know, barely bigger than the golf ball. And I think that would just, I think it would help the issue. And I totally agree with him.
So, speaking of courses again, what is the best course that you've competed on? And then what course have you most enjoyed competing on? So best being fairly objective, like I think this is the course I would rate the highest that I've played on. And okay, what is the one that you've competed on that you enjoy the most?
The best course I've competed on, and I think it's not even close, I played the USAM at Pebble Beach in 2018 when it was in perfect shape. And I really don't think there's a whole lot better golf courses in the world in general. I mean, obviously people complain about how long the rounds are during recreational play, but since we played it in a tournament setting, I was just blown away. I'd never been out there before. Honestly, I know it's a perennial top 10 course in the country, or at least top 12, but I think it's underrated. It's just so much fun to play. And like, I don't know, I'm a sucker for staring out at oceans during a tournament or whatever. So that kind of hit both sides of the coin for me. And then most fun I've had on a golf course is probably Prairie Dunes. We played the Big 12s there. I guess it was not my senior year, but my junior year. And, you know, that golf course is unbelievable. I mean, you like, it's an old Perry Maxwell, or at least nine holes is Perry. The back nine is Press. And, it just, the greens are so wild, and you have to think about every shot coming in the greens. And I kind of ate that up. A lot of guys were turned off by it. It was windy, and you just have to play shots and, you know, versus hitting that straight ball. And I felt like it played right into my hands, and I played, obviously when you play well, you're going to have fun, but like
that course really emphasized that for me.
What do you think embodies the best intersection between competitive golf and great architecture? Because I've said before that I've played a few like really tip-top courses in competition, and they don't feel perfectly applicable to the modern day competitive game. And so to you, when you've played some really great places that have been just excellent competitive experiences as well, what are the things that you think tease that out?
I think there's a great mix of long holes and short holes. You know, you go to a place like Country Club Charleston, it's incredible. But scores are usually pretty low out there because there's really not one long par four out there except for number 18. And it's like, you know, you got to have a mix of 480-yard par fours and 390-yard par fours. When there's just like, you know, 390, 420, 440, 400, whatever, I don't think that's testing the best golfers. Everybody's hitting a wedge in no matter what. And so there is no advantage to hitting your driver straight. So I think it is important to find that, like you said, intersection between, you know, long and short holes, because without it, I mean, I think it literally just brings a much bigger portion of the field into play. And I don't think necessarily the best player always wins.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that the long holes are kind of what hold up a course. Like, let's continue with the Country Club Charleston theme. Like the 18th hole, you know, you're going to have a rare birdie. You're going to have a double here and there. But for the most part, people are going to make four or five. But what I think makes the course great is you get the wind blowing and like the middle of the back nine kind of holes 12, 13, 14, you know, some of those shorter, difficult par or can be very difficult par fours. I mean, you're going to have a lot of threes and you're going to have guys make sixes and sevens to get sideways and bunkers. And that to me what makes courses really interesting is when the shorter holes are what really start to diverge the scores. And then the longer holes are just kind of the bootstraps to the course that hold everything up.
Totally agree. You know, obviously those shorter holes, you can make a three quickly, make a six quickly. But the weather really dictates that. But with no wind, I really think those longer holes are important. Or else, you know, I just think the entire field is more apt to play well.
Yeah, totally. I'm going to get you out of here on three somewhat shorter questions that detract a little bit from course architecture, but first one here is going to stay in it. So I want to hear, and you can provide color or no color on this, but I want to hear your top three courses in the world, in the United States, and in Texas.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, Pine Valley, number one. I've been there a couple times and I just don't think there's anything more unique in the world. Feels like you're playing almost a different golf course on every hole. I would say Augusta is my number two. We've been lucky enough to go there every year I was in school. We had a few alumni take us. And then I think number three would have to be Seminole. Where we played the Walker Cup this year. I guess these are more US based golf courses, but I haven't played too much outside of the United States. But, you know, Seminole just changes on a daily basis based on the wind. I mean, you've got holes like number two, number 11 that'll play. I mean, in the practice round this year at Walker Cup, we were hitting lob wedges in a number two, and then the wind switched and we were hitting five iron. I mean, it's just like that discrepancy in clubs that you're hitting into the greens just based on the wind is just wild and changes the way the green complexes work. The false fronts and the slopes become much more dramatic based on the wind direction. And obviously it's just an incredible Donald Ross course, but you know, it just gets better and better. I feel like the longer it's been there, and I don't think it's so fun to play. You can see every hole in the golf course. It's an easy walk, and you step up on the tee on number 17 and look out at the ocean, and then you know, tell yourself to just tell yourself good luck and try to make a four on one of the hardest par threes in the world. That's not a, you know, 250 yard par three like every single golf course has nowadays. It seems like it's just, that's another thing that bothers me about the golf course, the modern golf course, is that everybody thinks that you need, you know, three par threes over 210 yards. And it's just like, no, yeah, I mean, a 160 yard par three, 180 yard par three, you know, maybe throw in 120 yard par three and have one long par three is totally fine. It still tests everyone, but it makes the golf course so much more fun. And I think Seminole has a good mix of that.
I love the people that say, I don't get it. I don't see what's so good about Seminole. I'm like, yeah, you don't get it because it's fantastic. You know, I think Seminole is, yeah, in all the ways that you described, the simplicity, the conditions of it, you know, the way that the wind affects things day to day, the way that you have to be around the greens. It's just, it's an incredible golf course. It's so much fun to play, usually, sometimes not so much so. But yeah, really just an absolute gem.
Yeah, and then if we're getting outside of the U.S., I've only played in Europe three times, but really two golf courses stand out to me. I think I played over in near Liverpool for the first Walker Cup in 2019. Hoylake was awesome, and, you know, has so much history there. But we played Royal Birkdale while we were over there. And I mean, what a test of golf. And it's just so different than anything I'd ever played before. Blind shots, you know, wind whipping, balls just rolling wherever it pleases. And, you know, you're kind of built back into these dunes and it's just, it's remarkable. I mean, I think our entire Walker Cup team played out there that day and everybody in my group had a putt on the last hole to break 80. I mean, it was just brutal. And, you know, I think that kind of golf is fun sometimes. But then, you know, moving away from that, I played the Open Championship last year at Royal St. George's, and that golf course was incredible too. It's pretty highly ranked, so I don't need to sing its praises too much. But, I mean, it's fun. Some of those courses over there are fun because you've got – out of balance basically right on the fairway, and it's so different than golf courses in the States. Like, I mean, you don't really see that anywhere, so it just makes you think of that much more. Top three in Texas, I think my number one is Brook Hollow in Dallas. That was just redone.
It looks amazing. The work there looks just fantastic.
It's incredible. It really is. They've restored it back to where it was. I think it's an old tilling house. I need to double check that, but I think it is. The bunkering is just fantastic. But then second favorite is probably Champions in Houston, Jackie Burke's place. It's great. It's a championship golf course, but it's fun to play. It's not just boring old long hole after long hole. There's some, you know, there's some character, and the greens are massive, probably some of the biggest greens anyone will ever play on. And they just redid their green complexes too, a couple years back before they hosted the Women's Open. So it's been fun to play out there a bunch. And then I'd say my third favorite is probably Whispering Pines. There's some incredible holes out there. There really are. It's not like, you know, designed by a world renowned architect, but it's really good. It's got sand dunes. It's kind of got a bit of a Pinehurst feel. And you don't find that anywhere else in Texas. So I think those three would be, the way I'd vote in a magazine.
So sticking with the Texas theme here, what are your top three restaurants in Austin? I ask this somewhat selfishly. I'm looking for recommendations, frankly.
All right. So casual, I'm sure you've been. Matt's El Rancho, Mexican food. I love Mexican food. I don't know if you do, but it's unbelievable. Absolutely. They've got great, great, great queso, awesome margaritas. It's just, it's a great spot to go hang out with some boys. And, you know, get your Mexican fix in. But then
My favorite Italian place is Red Ash, but if you want to go ahead and hop on Open Table and get a reservation now, because I mean, it's almost impossible to get a reservation like 2 months in advance. It's ridiculous how crowded it gets. It's a small restaurant, but the food is unbelievable. You got to go for the gnocchi when you're there. And then my third favorite would be Lonesome Dove. It's got a welcome to Texas feel. I mean, it's a full blown ranch, like a modern, really nice ranch vibe. And they've got like rattlesnake sausage, elk, lamb, you name the animal and they have it there. And it is remarkably good. Some of the best hush puppies I've ever had. So if you get the chance, check out those three. Well worth your time.
I love hearing that about Lonesome Dove. I've heard really good things about it, and that's kind of up my alley, trying out some exotic meats and things like that. So I'm excited to try that at some point.
Yeah, I mean, that's a staple for sure.
Okay, last question of the day, and we'll get you out of here on this one, Cole. Three words to describe your approach to the next season.
All right. Number one, definitely patience. Number two, commitment. I just want to be committed in everything I do, every shot I hit, and not leave anything out there. And then three, have fun. I mean, even though I'm doing this as a profession, I mean, you got to have fun with it. You got to enjoy what you do. And so you put too much pressure on yourself. It's very easy to get worn out. That's the last thing I want, especially as a 23-year-old. So yeah, patience, commitment, and having fun, I think are the three characteristics that I need to implement for next season.
And drink coffee.
Yeah, there you go. Drink lots of coffee, maybe even a little espresso.
There we go.